session of March 30, 1977. That said, I continue the figure entitled Names. I had given a few indications about the problem of nicknames, I would give this phenomenon a strange name known in linguistics as caritatism. It's a rare term even in linguistics. I didn't invent it. I'm not sure where I found it. It's a term for affectionate forms that are sometimes given to nouns referring to everyday objects in fashion magazines. There are many caritatisms. You say the snug little coat. Let's indicate in our corpus two forms of caritatism. Strangely enough, we'll find them in the most horrific narrative, a mix of bourgeois respectability, vermin and madness, the confined woman of Poitiers. In that reclusive family, with its seemingly inhuman relationships, mother and brother are accused of sequestering the daughter. And what I said should have made the police think a little more. But what was in a context of sequestration, there was a caritative language, a use of affectionate nicknames. The brother calls Melanie, not Melanie, but my little Gertrude. The sister called her alleged imprisoner brother little Pierre. Both children called their mother an elderly, austere, respectable lady, Bonine. I don't know why. This is an interesting phenomenon. I still don't know how to explain it. At times, within a family, names are changed. One gives alternative first names to a person's official name. One invents inexplicable nicknames, probably a forgotten incident from childhood. Most likely, the invention of new names is a way of breaking with everyone else and creating a supremely safe enclosure, a new integration. In short, it is a conversion. If one invents a new name, it's a real conversion, and it's like a baptism. Changing language is the first step in all renewals, all birth, all strong integrations. It's an initial linguistic gesture. At times, in communal languages, there is a break, like those communes I mentioned several times in the 60s and early 70s, like what you see in the US or in farms in the south of France. There's a whole book about this by Droit Galien, la chasse au bonheur. He describes those communities. One doesn't know how to call the people in those communes. At times they are called communards, to call up the Paris Commune. The communal language in these communities is not necessarily a new language. There is a rupture, but not a different language. Among the communards, there's a young woman called Liz. She came there because she found she could no longer breathe in Paris. This is the theme of pollution. The myth of pollution, that's an active myth. What is felt as pollution is decency. To mark her integration in the commune, she has a very gross language. She begins every sentence with putain, something like fuck. She can't be asked. When Dadoun, her son, tears a page in a book, she shouts, fuck, that guy's an idiot. This language can be defined by what it rejects. Everyone among us thinks he or she speaks a natural language, but my language reveals who I am. In Mélanie's language, the sequestered woman, there are two languages, depending on the social context. She has a first language established in the social context that is extremely foul, a rejection of the bourgeois milieu. When she's taken to the hospital, after she's released, she refuses to reply to questions and answers with swear words and obscenities. This is the refuse of a break. This is what she called a grotto, a great back malampia. But she also has a communal language. For Mélanie, the community is her own company. In that language, is always punctuated by childish caritatisms. For instance, she will speak about a pen, a dear little pencil, a dear little rose. She applies this to all objects. She will ask for a dear little blanket, which is encrusted with filth and insects, and she would cover her head with it. She wants to eat a dear little chicken. She wants to eat some dear little punnets, strawberries, and then a dear little chocolate macaroon. This very visible function of these caritatisms is to change the status of the noun, of the common noun. A common noun is turned into a proper noun. She individualizes the object. My dear little blanket makes it into a sort of person. It becomes incomparable. It becomes a proper name. Caritatism denotes the ultimate reference as irreductible. We can think of this famous line in Corneille's Medea. In such extreme misery, we know that Medea takes revenge against Jason, who has left her for another woman, by slitting her children's throats. She goes on, "What are you left with? Myself." In total confinement, what are you left with? My pencil, my chicken, my strawberries, my chocolate macaroons. The name is the name of what I love. It's my name. I only name what I love. Melanie can only name what she loves. I only name what's worth naming. Third series of observations about names, the no name. Indeed, the caritatic appellation starts looking like a form of anti-nomination. I draw names out of the generality of language. The purpose of nomination in language is to classify the whole of reality so that it's manageable, but in caritative language, I reject everything that isn't an object of love. I destroy language. There's nothing but objects of love. Love is a dual space. One can think that caritative appellations implies a whole dual, is therefore not compatible with communal living. It's a space of manipulation with only proper names. In the communal space, there's a new danger. Danger of surnames, proper names. And also, there is the danger of gossip. Benveniste has mentioned in a famous demonstration of the third person. The third person is the non-person. It is absent from the others. It turns the other into somebody being talked about. When we talk about someone as he, we make him or her absent. The proper name is referential, is the name of something that is absent. The community, by manipulating proper names, transforms these names into third persons about whom one speaks. Il, elle, he, she are aggressive pronouns. When you say he or she about the person you love, you mean you're angry. In the ideal utopia of community, there would be no names. Just calls, just presences, just invocations. Nothing absent. There wouldn't be any manipulation through the name. This is about names. About food now. The problem of the symbolization of food would merit a whole encyclopedia. I thought at some point of producing one. An encyclopedia of food. I would not have been the only writer, of course. But as a reaction to the unilateral commercializations of modern cookery books, they are presented as rational. They seemingly forget the fact that we still associate food with symbols and rituals. There's a contemporary mythology about that. The grand ideological imposture of hygiene, of health. It would be a very vast encyclopedia from the Tao to the Bible, from the Bible to Lévi-Strauss. The raw and the cooked. So again, what I'll do is just a preliminary sketch. I'll talk about rhythms, the food themselves, practices. Rhythms, that is, schedules of food consumption. I see three problems. The timing of community meal times. It's important, first, because this is what breaks with a certain continuity and what gives rhythm to daily life. There is a relation between an implacable rhythm and the otium, the rural pensioners' meticulously planned schedules. People who are retired, for instance, or who are in the countryside, I insist upon a very precise schedule. Second, in those communities, the meal is an opportunity to come together for conviviality. The anachorites of Egypt, even in solitude, still abide by a regulating schedule. In general, they would just have one meal a day, taken around the noon, the ninth, that is 3 p.m., after the afternoon nap. Then there was a lot of hesitation until the emergence of the strict rules of Occidental cenobitism. In some contexts, only one meal a day, taken whenever it's wanted. In others, there'd be a communal meal in a refectory for midday and evening time. There is also the possibility of eating your meal alone in your cell, but being forbidden to store any food there. If one reduces to the maximum the schedules, or if you regularize to the extreme, you will have a transparent rule, a very regular schedule makes time become transparent. Time will become completely legible. This to adopt an inflexible schedule, because the code absence, far more than spontaneity or irregularity. Second problem in rhythms, a problem known to all Christianity, the link between schedules and fasts. Ascetic excesses with Oriental anachorites will deal with fasts by doing away with meal times altogether. In many cases, we hear about hunger strikes. They can last several days. Commonly, the anachorite will just have one paltry meal per day. With the great founders of rules, we see that they do not eat much, but often. You must always stay hungry. You know, it's today a rule for weight loss cures. Eat often, but very little each time. To be slimmer, you have to be hungry. Saint Jerome, in the 4th century, wrote to Furia, a young widow, rather than fast for 3 days, choose plain food so your stomach is never full. It's better to eat a little each day than gorge yourself every so often. Saint Jerome speaks of a voracious abstinence. The rhythm that Saint Jerome condemns, like eat suddenly a lot, was derived from economic constraints. The irregularity of resources created this alternation that you had until the Middle Ages between meager meals and sudden abundance. Suddenly there would be a lot to eat. This was the regime in the Middle Ages. It's not such a long time ago that men have started eating in a very regular manner. This is what explains the, for us, unintelligible, unrealistic character of descriptions of menus from the past. They look totally impossible. The literature about food would only write down those excessive feasts. In those feasts, one should never forget that they write down everything that was on the table, but each eater would only eat from a few dishes, not all. And then third remark about rhythm, there's a different way of absenting food that is not paying for it, forcing it to operate outside an economy of exchange. Usually we think that we have to work to earn a crust, earn a living. In the case of ascetics, you discard the principle of exchange, and one thinks food as a supplement. To ask and be given food, not money. It's a universal practice in the histories of religion. What's most interesting for me is the way food charity is symbolized in Buddhism. Food is absented on three counts. First, by not earning it, letting it come. Two, not asking for it. Three, it's still most amazing, not looking at it. Indeed, in Ceylon monasteries, even if your alms were regular, and it was a public and symbolic presentation of alms. The round takes place around 10 a.m. These are very small monasteries. The monks come out one by one. There's one monk for every group of houses. Then they return to the monastery singly, and then the meal is around noon. The monk holds the bowl against his chest, hidden under his robe. The monk walks with his eyes cast down, slowly, but resolutely, without hesitation. Every now and then, the monk pauses in front of a house or a shop, and he waits, without looking at the door. Someone comes out, opens the monk's robe, and puts some food in the bowl, or takes it from him to fill it in the kitchen, and returns it to the monk. The layman bows, the monk mutters a blessing, slowly walks away. And the monk is still silent, and he doesn't even glance at the food. You have noted all the operations of annulment, not only of the food, but even of the act of asking for food. In all those problems of food rhythms, we associate different structures, or strictly speaking, different ideologies, two different sorts of rhythm. First, there is a multifactory rhythm that suppresses food, punishes the body, very common in Christianity. Then, there is a neutral rhythm that absents food, tries to make it transparent, insignificant, and non-effective, not desired. That's about rhythms. not substances, the food themselves. It's an endless list of questions. The problem of the taboo, which an old hobby horse of anthropoethnology, not to speak of psychoanalysis. There is a division in the forbidden. The division is between what's forbidden, what's tolerated. There are prohibitions that are universally known. Meat that is replaced by fish during Lent. Fish is allowed, meat is prohibited. We know that rabbit was considered as fish. There was also the division between animal and vegetable substances. We see this in the Old Testament with all the taboos. You couldn't eat escalope normand with cheese and meat. There are two interdictions, two prohibitions that show what a maze these interdictions offer. The first prohibition is one practiced by Oriental anachorites. They had very strong taboos. They would eat essentially raw salad leaves, something called lacana, kind of lettuce. They had green vegetables. The vegetables that could be eaten raw, salt, and bread. The usual diet was 2 6-ounce loaves per person, per day, something like 340 grams of bread per day. That was allowed. What was forbidden was cooked food, wine, of course, oil, except at the communal meal on Saturdays, and plants with pods. Why oil? This is interesting. We see Pacomius, Saint Pacomius, one day sees oil on his crushed salt. He shouted, "The Lord was crucified and I'm eating oil." Oil is not a liquid, but a dense substance, and it's extremely nourishing. We have to interrogate language. There's something that should alert us today. Soups are liquid, but we still say, eat and not drink soup. There is here the euphoric theme of lubrication. Why potted vegetables like peas, broad beans? They are probably forbidden because they are too nourishing. They nourish too much and they are forbidden. There may be another symbolic system. in Tao, there is a strict prohibition against cereals for a completely different reason than that of luxury. In the Tao, cereals are supposed to cause death. The Tao has two aspects. One is the philosophical side, connected with Lao Tzu's writings, but there is also the magical aspect of the popular religion. In the magic side, the Tao wants to immortalize the body. The Tao, unlike the Greek and Christian traditions, will not distinguish the body from the soul. The Christian project of making the soul immortal doesn't have any meaning in Tao. They want to make the body immortal. In order to make the body immortal, one has to fight against the demons in our own bodies. And the demons are worms that would hatch inside the body, that would eat away at its vitality. In the Tao, there are three kinds of worms in the human body. The first one is called Old Blue. It's a worm that is in the top parts of the body. It causes blindness, deafness, baldness, makes your teeth fall out. The second one, as marvelous a name, is called White Lady. It's a worm that causes heart palpitations, asthma, melancholy. The third worm has a horrible name, the Bloody Corpse. It gives colics, rheumatisms, it causes your skin to age, it causes fatigue and early dementia. The role of the Tao subject is to fight against those worms. Stop eating rice, millet, wheat, oats, and beans. That's what they write. The five cereals are scissors that cut off life. They rot the five internal organs. They shorten it. If a grain enters your mouth, do not hope for life eternal. If you desire to escape death, your intestine must be free of it. Cereals are evil because they are the essence of the earth. They are yin, and the sky is yang. I've quoted the Tao because this interdiction is not related to sin. There's no atonement through mortification, but it is a metaphysical anatomy of the body. Everybody talks about the body. What interests me now is to study the body insofar as it is historical. The Tao gives very precious indications. Another subtle distinction is the charity sought by Buddhist monks. They can accept anything that's put in a bowl, with the exception of wine, as long as it's been prepared. Vegetables, fish, meat. If the food is uncooked, they are not allowed to accept meat, fish, or eggs. The servants in the monastery can buy meat and fish, but they cannot buy eggs because they would have to break them. By breaking an egg, they would be killing a life. But if you get it, if you're given it already broken, it's okay. You see the same abstention from responsibility as in the request for food. The object is accepted, but there shouldn't be any agency about it. This is the huge rule in Asia of Wu Wei non-action. The equation is non-action and yet life nevertheless. It's not an easy equation to balance. Our world today doesn't allow for this equation. I'd like to talk about the connotations of food. Indeed, a menu, as soon as it is glanced at or narrated, has meaning in excess of its basic function. To read ham, salad, potatoes is not the same thing as reading foie gras, stuffed quails, pheasant, asparagus. It's not just a straightforward mechanism of transformation, turning a fact into a marker and a marker into a sign. What's expensive indexes what is in small supply, and that marker becomes a sign in a complex system. A self-perpetuating system of interlocutory images. There's a whole semiology of food. It could not establish simple lists. There is, for instance, the case of pot-au-feu. Originally, it was a food that was very rustic, popular. At Paris, when you had coach drivers, you had restaurants for them, and the main dish for them was salted beef. The pot-au-feu can now become luxury, a mark of luxury. You see it in magazines. It functions as a supreme luxury, as the image of an elaborated rusticity. There are great, not great restaurants, but expensive restaurants that serve pot-au-feu now. Whole system of social images is associated with food. We could see the eventful history of pizza. Originally, it was the most ordinary meal, the cheapest meal for the proletariat of Naples. When it moved to Paris, it was a sort of form of Italianity. It became snobbish. And then it goes back to being a sign of ordinary, cheap food. The pizzeria in Saint-Germain. It's the end of the dialectics of pizza. The system would, of course, have to be re-described for each historical period. Brillat-Savarin established systems and codes and menus that correspond to social levels. Give me your income and I'll give you your menu. He has a series of gastronomic test tubes, we could call them tests. This is the first series. This is the archetype of a menu. Income, 5,000 francs, not very well off. This is the menu. A large fillet of veal, larded with fat bacon and cooked in its own juices. A domestic turkey, stuffed with Lyon chestnuts. Fattened pigeons covered with bacon and well cooked. Eggs à la neige, a dish of sauerkraut, bristling with sausages, crowned with smoked bacon from Strasbourg. After each of his menus, Brillat-Savarin gives a sort of phraseology. The formula changes. Now the expression is say now, that looks damn good. Come on, let's do it justice. The second series, income 15,000 francs, comfortably well off. A fillet of beef, pink inside, larded and cooked in its own juices. A side of venison, a boiled turbot, a choice leg of mutton à la Provençale, a truffle turkey, first green peas of the season, comment, ah, my dear fellow, what delightful sight. It is a veritable wedding feast. Third series, presumed income, 30,000 francs, wealthy. A 7-pound fowl stuffed round as bought with Périgord truffles, an enormous pâté of foie gras from Strasbourg in the shape of a bastion, a large carp from the Rhine à la Chambord, which he dressed and decorated, truffed quails à la moelle on canopy of toast spread with butter, a stuffed and basted river pike covered with a cream of shrimps, secundum artem, two dozens of ortolans à la Provençale. Comment, ah, my sir, my lord, what an admirable chef you have. It is only at your banquets that we can enjoy such delicacies. From the moment we do such alimentary semiology, you have a diachronic history. Brillat-Savarin talks about this evolution. Meals and foods are values that are quotable on the stock exchange of history. For Brillat, eggs à la neige is a sign of low income today of a good restaurant. The system of food connotations generates circular traces of the grand symbolism of food that the imaginary takes from nature and presents as social appearance. Society has become our nature. Now, a few examples of menus to sketch this semiology of food. For instance, what do they have for breakfast, the monks? They have coffee and milk and sugar and galettes. Then they have rice with curry, vegetable, fresh fermented milk, dinner tea or coffee with sugar, no milk or fruit juice. Frugality, vegetarianism, but also occidentality and comfort. Nothing ascetic in the Buddhist monasteries of Ceylon. The French communities in France around 1970, called communards, so for midday, a mushroom omelette, a salad, some goat cheese. Evening, potatoes cooked in garlic or brown rice, grilled chestnuts. The connotation is rusticity, Frenchness, omelette, semi-vegetarianism, cult of the microbiotic. And now, Mélanie's food, the sequestered woman. She lived for 25 years in an unbelievable filth, in confinement. But the paradox was that in this terrible bedroom, dirty, she was given a very sophisticated and expensive ultra-bourgeois food. Although her mother was a miser for breakfast, she would only have one cup of Compagnie Coloniale hot chocolate without any bread for lunch. A fried fillet of sole, a chop surrounded by potatoes, at times from the Hôtel de France in Poitiers, chicken breast with mushrooms, chicken in tomato sauce, oysters, foie gras. And she would drink a Bordeaux wine, the best one, at 2 or 3 francs a bottle. Dinner, she would just have a brioche or a cake called a Jesuit. I'm not sure what this is. I look for it everywhere. A cake that is called a Jesuit, what can it be? Here we have connotations, Frenchness, it's also bourgeois, and a high degree of capriciousness. Another meal or menu. If you were hungry, this would take off your appetite. It's in Zola's potluck, the meal in the Josserand's apartment, living high up. There were the hard-up bourgeois household, struggling with the need to keep up appearances, to try not to rouse suspicion. This was the problem of the social appearance. To butter up one uncle, Uncle Bachelard, and to get him to stamp up 50,000 francs as a dowry for one of the girls, they give him a dinner. There was some dubious skate in an overly vinegary black butter, a greasy meat pie, a piece of veal, green beans swimming in water, vanilla and currant ice cream swimming in water too. Borrowing from the epic device, Zola gives the signifies himself. At least he splits the signifier into two. If we see the words, the names, it looks correct, it looks okay. On its face value, fish, tartar, roast, ice cream. When I was teaching abroad, this was more or less what we were served. Fish and French beans, that was the code. Here, this is a sort of honorable code. But each time, Zola adds a very negative, unappealing attribute. It's doubtful, it's swimming in water, it's greasy. This is Zola's theme. Bourgeoisie is just a facade of appearances, and it conceals a different reality. There is a social lie. I'll give you a last menu. The menu of the man eating alone. We have this in many restaurants. Wismans describes this in Avolo. The gloomy descriptions of meals eaten in bad local restaurants by the bachelor. You also have the sublimated food of the solitary philosopher. This is happy, sober food. At the end of his life, Spinoza retreats to a room in a place called Verbo. He was given meals in his room. For a whole day, he would live on a milk soup done with butter and a pot of beer. Another day, he eats nothing but gruel with raisins. He would only have 2 half pints of wine a month. Sobriety, frugality, naturality. Like the monks in Ceylon, even more reasonable. It goes without saying that we are dealing here with connotations. There are no objective attributes associated with a given social condition. This belongs to semiology, science. Food is taken in a play of mirrors. It's food as we read it in a story, in a narrative, or in a biography. We should also tackle the idea of food as a private secret. The menu can be secret. This reminds me of my first year at the École pratique des hautes études 15 years ago. I wanted to gather a set of menus to study them. I'd asked all the participants in my group to tell me what they were eating. I was too naive. There was an enormous resistance in disclosing their own menus. It had to remain private. To speak about what one is eating publicly was still a taboo then. Another word about the last term. I want to finish before vacation. The problem of eating together in the practices is just to remember that we need to go back to it. It's too enormous. Just for the record, it's an enormous ethnographical dossier. The rituals, feasts, banquets. First, there is the horror of eating alone. It seems widespread. It's really general. There is a certain malediction. It's the essence of solitude. To eat alone manifests solitude. Is the privileged object of a philosophical or mystical reversal. At times, there is a perversion, a narcissistic pleasure in eating alone while reading. Second level, the rituals of communion. Collective ingestion of a symbolic foodstuff. With the theme of no one breaks bread with their enemy. Third, ecstatic communions. All those practices in which the subject is deprived of his protective armor. The extreme form would be the orgy. In our culture, there are blander substitutes of that incitement to ecstasy, the banquets, the family meals, in which you have intoxication brought about by alcohol, a lot of food, the excessive length of meal times. Banquets, family meals are very long. There is a sort of intoxication achieved by time. The characteristic of an orgy is that you cannot measure it. There is no moderation. When I was a young teacher in Romania, you had a Slavic practice in the Balkans that called the Kievs. You would lock yourself up between friends a whole weekend. And you would just eat and talk. No sense of time. You would eat whenever you wanted, the way you wanted, for maybe 48 hours. Finally, conviviality as an encounter. The meal eaten together is a crypto-erotic scene where things happen. This is very well described in The Magic Mountain. The inhabitants of the sanatorium are happy to meet during meals. We have everything about changing places at the table. There is an overdetermination of pleasures. The pleasure of amorous meetings. The last remark. Food is, of course, associated with life. That is what is biologically vital. But through a metonymical reversal, all the metaphors for life are reversed when it comes to food. There's a symbolic exchange between changing your lifestyle, changing the food you eat. The three great births of man as the embryo by intussusception ingests the substance of the mother, then the mother's breast milk, and then weaning. The patients in the sanatorium of the Magic Mountain are there to save their lives. They want to be reborn outside of illness. They are served monstrously stodgy foods. They are stuffed with food in the hope that this will turn them into new human beings. But if you do a weight loss cure, this is the reverse. The subject who starts such a cure is the wish to change your life. Be born into a new life, to be reborn young. There is not one weight loss that doesn't have a very strong symbolic mechanism, and that has something religious. Last observation. To pass from one sort of food to another, for instance, the problem of a man who gets married. You move from your mother's food to your wife's food. If it is accepted, it will be that of a second mother. Petit bourgeois man would call their wives mother, mommy. That passage from one food to the other can involve a whole inner labor. There is work, like the work of mourning and the work of rebirth. This is it. Have a great vacation and see you next time. Aaron? Sorry, we need to cut this one because I cannot do the unhappily. It's a short one though, but